thinking big thoughts so you don't have to. Here's John Williams.
Here we go. Mm-hmm.
109. Hey, it's John. Wishing you a really happy weekend. We're getting to that a little early here, aren't we? But Friday at 109 feels pretty good to me. And remember, we'll do something called The Bright Side in about an hour and a half. That's the real kickoff to the weekend on WGN Radio here in Chicago. We'll ask you to call in, tell us something good in your world. Why are you smiling? And we will smile with you. That's The Bright Side. We do that Fridays. If you've not heard it before, it's really that simple. I know it sounds cheesy. I promise you, it works every single time. People call in and say, hey, we've got a budget. And then everybody calls in and says other things that are making them happy. What I don't know, Ryan, is how happy I should be about this budget. Is this the sort of thing I should be clicking my heels over?
The budget?
Yeah.
Well, we get Powerball and Mega Millions back.
Well, then that's all I need to know.
It comes at the expense of a 32% income tax increase.
Wah, wah.
And it doesn't sound like our Republicans and Democrats in the state are still getting along. So
whatevs.
Yeah.
It is unfortunate that Illinoisans, in that case, are not as cheeky as the Russian president and the president of these United States. 2 hours and 16 minutes they met. I don't know what that's supposed to mean, 2 hours and 16 minutes. I think the idea is that that's a very long time. But, you know, you think about it. What literally is a meeting like that? Our two top dogs, they're two big guys, couple of translators. And it means that President Trump says hello, and then the translator says hello, and then the guy hears it, and then he says, hi, how are you? And then it kind of goes back and forth. So everything is rather extenuated that way. And what kind of real conversation can you have?
Well, they apparently talked about Syria. They talked about North Korea. And, of course, the White House says, or at least cabinet officials say, that they did talk about Russian interference.
Yeah, I'm glad about that. And that's the transcript I want to see. Now, you are telling me that we are getting conflicting views of how that conversation went, huh?
Yeah, the White House, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson saying that President Trump did push Vladimir Putin on the issue of interfering in the American elections, to which Putin apparently responded back that they did not do it. He denied everything. Now, Sergey Lavrov, the representative for...
Sergey?
Yes.
Is that your kind of pal name with him? You're close enough that you call Sergey... Sergey?
So there you go.
Sergey the man.
The Russian foreign minister.
Yes. The Sergmeister.
Exactly. Gave a televised press conference where he said essentially that the Trump administration accepted the denial from Russia. And then, of course, you know, everyone went and took that to the American cabinet members that said, no, that's not the case at all.
Okay, so maybe the president addresses this out of the gate. I'm glad to hear that. Let's just deal with the elephant in the room. And the Russian president promises that he did not meddle, that the, I presume, therefore, the Russians did not meddle. And the Russian version of this is that the U.S. president accepted that and said, OK, we're cool.
In the meantime, Robert Mueller had an ear against the door, don't you think?
Yeah, I'm just going to Twitter now to see if Donald Trump is tweeting, Vladimir Putin better hope that I didn't, quote unquote, tape or have tapes of the exchange, because we're already disagreeing about how that went. But is the takeaway, Ryan, as you read this, that regardless of, you know, who said what to whom, are we agreeing that they both agreed that the Russians did not meddle, right? That is... Or no, the U.S. is denying that version.
I mean, the Russia's clearly denying that they meddled and told the president as such. Now the question is, does the president believe them? The White House cabinet members say, no, the president does not believe them.
Okay. So maybe as much ground as we'd hoped was not made.
But the fact that the issue was forced, I guess, is something that's probably going to be the readout for the day, I assume, on all the headlines.
Oh, for sure. And then here in Illinois, of course, it is. So now that we have a budget passed, excuse me, what does that mean for the average person? And my friend Kristen McQuarrie on the Chicago Tribune editorial board pointed out that the Daily Herald yesterday had a pretty smart piece about this. The Tribune's editorial on the budget that our lawmakers have crafted is positively scathing. But the Daily Herald said, here's what a 32% tax increase means for you and for me. Remember, we're going from 3.75% to just under 5%. From 3.75% to just under 5%. I came from Minnesota. The state personal income tax there is 9 or 9.75. It's a whopper. At the end of the day, you don't care if your state income tax goes up or if your soda tax goes up. You care what your total tax is, right? I mean, I'm writing a check to this guy and to that guy and to that guy. At the end of the day, I want to know how much do I have left. And so even if our state income tax is less than some neighboring states or the really flush Minnesota, they're arguing over how to spend a $2 billion surplus. Think about that. But at the end of the day, your concern is how much is left for me. And so if our state income tax has been relatively low or is now in the middle of the pack, I'm still not sure we necessarily get to take a lot of consolation from that because we have so many other taxes and fees. I get the feeling, now I haven't seen somebody do an analysis of this, that here in Illinois, here in Cook County, we are paying as much per person, per capita, per something or another, as anybody else, anywhere else. You know what I mean? And then you can also, if you just want to drive yourself mad, ask what are you getting for it? In this case, it's debt service, among other things. But here's what the Daily Herald did. They said, okay, a single person with this tax increase who earns $34,000 a year, are you a single person in the $34,000 a year neighborhood, you are going to pay an additional $382 a year if you are $382. If you're a family of three and you're making $75,000 a year, you are going to lose $822, or as I like to put it, almost $1,000. That strikes me as a lot. If you're making $75,000 and you're two adults and a child, and maybe you want to go on vacation, maybe if you're smart, you're saving for college, you are now going to just chuck out the window an extra $822. A family of four earning $150,000 pays an additional $1,700. A 66-year-old retiree who has $5,000 in taxable earnings, plus Social Security and pension income, which are not taxed in Illinois, will now pay an additional $22 a year. So maybe that's not so frightening for you, but I think a family of four making $150,000, which is not getting rich, that is not getting rich, they now pay $1,695 more. And the family of three at $75,000, $822 more. I hope they're not patting themselves on the back too hard down there in Springfield. By the way, there's a story in the Chicago Sun Crimes today which positively stunned and shocked me. I will share it with you now. The vanity plates that you can get that feature team logos. I'm not exactly sure if that's what you call those, but the themed plates for our sports teams. You can get them for the Cubs, the Blackhawks, the White Sox, the Bears, etc. I think you could probably get it for U of I and Northwestern too. Okay, what's the number one one? What's the number one team Illinoisans want on their back of their car? Steve Bertrand, go.
Blackhawks?
Correct. I'm a little surprised, only because it's a smaller arena, and they're awesome, of course, but they haven't been awesome as long as, well, nobody's been awesome for long. So, okay, Blackhawks, good guess. Number one. Number two is
Chicago White Sox.
Did you read the article?
No.
How do you know that it's the White Sox?
There's a certain rabidity, enthusiasm with White Sox fans. You know, they're more to the core, so I think that they would be more likely to do it.
Cubs more so fans, than Cubs fans?
I don't know. I mean, a lot more Cubs fans, but I guess they're not. I don't know. I don't know why I thought that. I just kind of guessed it.
But. Well, you guessed right, and maybe this is it, and I think you're hinting at it. I think that White Sox fans feel so dismissed that they are going to be more inclined to circle the wagons, fly the flag, rally their troops, because ain't nobody else going to do it for them, right? So I don't want to say they have a chip on their shoulder. Let me put it this way. They have a chip on their shoulder.
It's like, here's my license plate. Knock it off.
Here's my license plate. Oh, you guys are just there for the party. And they get that. I mean, or they don't, but at least I understand it. White Sox fans, I'm not hating on you. I think I feel you a little bit there. Number three are the Chicago Cubs. You know, after the World Series, they ticked up a little bit here, but they're only number three. Number four are the Chicago Bears, who just won the Super Bowl in 86.
Just won it in 85?
Well, 86.
30 years ago?
Don't you get the feeling that, I mean, I know Mike Ditka's sort of fading and so on and so forth, but boy, this town sure did ride that thing for a long time.
Right.
If you are a Chicago Bear and you don't have a car dealership, a talk show, or a steakhouse in this town, that's on you, man. Because we have done nothing but beat a path to your door.
And then the Bulls are buying plates for the fans.
And then the Jimmy Butler-less Chicago Bulls, you know, that's maybe a good way to gauge the community's reaction. It's like, yes, if we had just got LeBron James, do you think the Cleveland Cavaliers plates in Ohio jumped up when LeBron decided to come back? You're darn right they did. When we get Zach LaVine and Lauri Markkanen, it didn't exactly explode the Chicago fan base for Bulls vanity plates. Now, I'm optimistic. I asked Dave Ennett yesterday. I said, Dave Ennett, I said, do you think that one team got better in that deal, or did they both get better, the Timberwolves and the Bulls for the trade? And he said, well, you've got some question marks there, but it's the short answer is, yeah, both teams got better. And guys do come back from the sorts of injuries that this Zach LaVine had. But I'm telling you, he's fun to watch. He is, and he gets better every game. He just doesn't play that many of them is the problem. So there's your top five vanity plates in Chicago. It goes Blackhawks, White Sox, Cubs, Bears, and finally the Bulls. And shame on the Bears, really, because, you know, baseball may be our pastime, but football is our passion in this country. And if you are the Chicago Bears and you've got that big old stadium and blah, 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 you should be number one. I'll bet it's number one in most towns. You think in Colorado, Broncos plates are number one? I'll bet they are. You think in Wisconsin, Packer plates are more common than Brewer plates? I could go down the list, right?
Half the Brewers have Packer plates.
Half the Brewers have Cubs fans at the games. Half the Brewers games. Malala is on Twitter. I mentioned this to you, Steve, moments ago. I think the timing could not be more perfect. Here in Chicago, here in Illinois, here in America, here on Earth, Malala is tweeting her first tweets. I'll read in a minute. Malala's first tweet. And you know who Malala is, right? In fact, Elle, if you have the audio of Malala, right? She is that young girl who is now, well, she's a young woman, but she's but 19. For all of the world that she has experienced, lived, and done, she is just 19 years old and is graduating from high school. Can you imagine? Malala is that young. She's always seemed so wise. When she spoke to the United Nations after having been pulled off a bus, shot by the Taliban because she was going to school and that was forbidden there, she survived, and she spoke to the United Nations. Part of her speech went like this.
I want education for the sons and daughters of the Taliban and all the terrorists and extremists. I do not even hate the Talib who shot me. Even if there is a gun in my hand and he stands in front of me, I would not shoot him. This is the compassion that I have learned from Muhammad, the Prophet of Mercy, and Jesus Christ and Lord Buddha. This is the legacy of change that I have inherited from Martin Luther King, Nelson Mandela, and Muhammad Ali Jinnah.
She was 16 when she gave that speech. If I'm wrong, I'm not wrong by much. I think she was 16. Can you imagine? Ella says yes, 16. So a few hours ago, she tweeted for the first time, "Hi, Twitter." Just dipping her toe in the water, and immediately got 31,000 likes and 7.4 thousand retweets and 1.9K comments. As a person who spends a lot of time on social media, I'm just a little jealous, Malala. Day one, you've already got a check mark. Seriously? You need to, shouldn't you have to work a little harder for it? She's blowing it up with her first high Twitter. And then she tweeted, "Today is my last day of school and my first day on at Twitter." 17,000 likes. Her next tweet, "Graduating from secondary school, high school, is bittersweet for me. I'm excited about my future, but I know that millions of girls around the world are out of school and may never get the opportunity to complete their education. Next week, I will be back on my hashtag girl power trip to meet girls in Middle East, Africa, and Latin America." And she tweeted, "Each girl's story is unique, and girls' voices are our most powerful weapons in the fight for education and equality." Is that last one was a five-tweet thread. And so Malala is out there, and I suggest that you follow her just because whatever else you're following is not that good. By the way, Steve, a friend of mine is a listener. He has a mutual friend, not a mutual friend, but a friend of his is a big listener, big fan of WGN. And this fan reached out to my friend, or maybe they didn't. Anyway, my friend said, "Hey, could I get an autographed picture of you, John, for this third party, this listener, this fan?"
Mm-hmm.
I said, "Sure. How am I going to get it to you? When do you need it?" He said, "I need it in 2 days. I said, "I'm not coming out to Naperville." I said, "I have some friends that head out to the suburbs. Wendy lives in LaGrange, and somebody else here lives, a few people out here live in my old neighborhood, but I'm just not." He goes, "Well, if you would just give the picture to one of them, they could drive it out to the neighborhood, to the suburbs, and I'll pick it up there." So I arranged for a colleague of ours here to do that. He said, "Yeah, I'll take it out." So I connected the two. I shared their contact information. And I said that the fan, the friend, can just come by and you can hand him the picture. But my colleague here who had the picture was a little leery about just letting somebody he doesn't know come to his house.
Yeah.
And I didn't know this, but they did exchange the photograph. But do you know how our friend here handed it off? He went to the LaGrange Public Library, and he went to the fiction section, and he got a book by Joy Williams, and he inserted the picture after page 720, actually page 72, and then he sent a picture of the book. He texted a picture of the book to the person who was supposed to pick it up and said, "The picture you want is at the library. It's on page 72. Here it is." He said, "I'm just a little leery about unknown people coming to my home these days." I said, "Was that you being a jerk or was that you being funny? Like, isn't this, hey, what a lark?" He said, "It was neither. That was me being apprehensive." I said, "I wonder if people are like that. Are you, would you, you wouldn't care if somebody met you at your house, would you?"
I haven't really given you my address, so.
Yeah. I guess that's right. The world we live in these days, you know, where if you're doing an exchange on Craigslist now, you're supposed to do it at the police station. But he was sufficiently careful that he, I said, "You've got to be kidding me." I said, "That was a friend of mine that you were giving the picture to." He said, "Well, I didn't know how close you were. I thought maybe that was just some random listener, and I'm not going to just let some random person come up and come to my house. So I put it on page 72 in a book after Williams in the library." He can find the library.
That's a lot of work.
That's a lot of work.
I would have done.
I know. I'd say, "Oh, what the heck? Maybe you're going to kill us all, but it's just not worth the effort. I'll just come on over. Come on over." That's the way that story ends. Okay, it's 1:30. If you have an observation or a similar anecdote, I know you don't have a story like that, text it to 312-981-7200. Your reaction to that, I'm interested in. 312-981-7200. News next on WGN. There's a display, a show in town. It's called "Then They Came for Me: Incarceration of Japanese Americans During World War II and the Demise of Civil Liberties." In our studio is the curator of this exhibit. I'll tell you where it is in just a second here. But first, let's welcome Tony Herschel, the director of exhibitions at the Alpha Wood Gallery. It's on Halsted, right? 20-something hundred?
2401 North Halsted at the corner of Fullerton.
What's Alpha Wood Gallery?
Alphawood Gallery is an extension of the work of the Alphawood Foundation, and it really presents exhibitions that are that offer topics of social relevance.
Art exhibitions.
Art exhibitions.
Various media?
In various media. This is the second one that we've done.
Huh. Oh, no kidding. So you guys are new?
We opened in December.
Oh, wow. And I don't know about this foundation or the people that are funding it. Talk about that for a second.
It's a foundation that seeks to create a just and equitable society, gives grants in arts and culture and social justice issues, and has been operating quietly for more than 25 years. And now this is a more public venture for the foundation.
So are they always going to staff or exhibit at this sort of storefront then?
Well, this the space has been lent to us, so we'll see. I think some kind of activity like this is going to continue. If it's in this space or another, we'll find out.
Well, let's remember Alphawood then, if not Halstead. But either way, that's where this exhibit is now. And it's called Then They Came For Me, Incarceration of Japanese Americans During World War II and the Demise of Civil Liberties. Why this exhibit now?
Well, it is convenient in one sense because it is the 75th anniversary of Executive Order 9066, which Franklin Roosevelt signed, and the executive order made possible the eviction of Japanese Americans from the West Coast, although it did not specify Japanese Americans in the text of the executive order.
Did it specify West Coast? Were all Japanese Americans
interred? It said that the military could determine zones from which any and all persons could be excluded. And so it was up to the military to determine where and who. And that's exactly what they did. But it was designed to make possible the removal of Japanese Americans.
From the West Coast.
From the West Coast. Oregon, Washington, California, and a part of Arizona.
Really? So if I was a Japanese American in Chicago, I might not have...
You would not have been forced to move. It was due to war hysteria in the wake of Pearl Harbor.
Oh, I get it. Yeah.
And there was fake news then, too. There were stories about Japanese submarines sighted off the coast of California. Not true. There were all sorts of stories.
But was there some espionage? Were there some Japanese Americans who were helping Japan?
There was a suggestion that that would be so. But in fact, of 10 acts of sabotage attributed to the Japanese government in this country during World War II, none of them were perpetrated by Japanese Americans.
Is it safe to say then that all of those people were not... did not need to be incarcerated?
I think that is certainly the conclusion now, and in fact, it was the conclusion of many people at the time.
Really? Was there outrage?
Yeah, there was outrage on the part of some people. There were even one of the photographers whose work is included in the exhibition, Dorothea Lange, beautiful, compelling, powerful photographs. She quit the program after a few months because she was so distressed by what she was seeing and said, you know, what is going to happen to these people? There were many people who said that, but at the same time, swept up by racism and hysteria, there was even Earl Warren, who was then Attorney General of California, went on to be Governor of California, went on, of course, to be famous Supreme Court Justice and repented. But at the time, he had said, you can't trust any of these people because they have an affiliation with Japan. We have to remove them from this most vulnerable part of the country.
Tony Herschel's in our studio, the director of exhibitions at the Alphawood Gallery on Halstead in Chicago. Then They Came For Me is this new exhibit. There's a film that screens every day there at 2 o'clock. I watched it. It tells this story as well. Do you have any sense of sympathy for the mindset at the time?
I certainly understand the fear that people had, and particularly when it was being whipped up by the government and other people. But at the same time, I think it's exactly moments like that when we have to be vigilant, demonizing a group of people who have done nothing aside from being of a certain ancestry, and deciding that they should all be locked up, that they would have to sell their homes and businesses. That's a very scary thing. Those are the moments when we have to resolve to defend our constitutional liberties.
Yeah. Walk me through how that happened. So this executive order is issued. The Army has the druthers?
In fact, the War Relocation Authority was established to oversee this program. And it was the War Relocation Authority that, in an effort to present a good picture of what they were doing, hired photographers to document it. They wanted to make sure that people understood that this was not the way, this was not the kind of policy that you would expect of our enemies in Germany and Japan, but that we were being humane. And so that was the reason they hired the photographers.
Were we? What was it like for these people?
Well, the first places that most people went were converted racetracks, horse racetracks, and the places that they were allowed to stay, they were staying in converted horse stalls where plywood had been thrown over the manure in the stalls. So this was no deluxe kind of camp at all. They weren't killing people, but they had forced them on very short notice to sell everything, to bring only what they would carry. That was the rule. And then to go without explanation of where they were going or how long they would be going for, they were taken away.
How did they select the people?
It wasn't selection. It was everyone.
Really? In this zip code, in this region.
There will be no more Japanese Americans. And also, they took away people who were Japanese citizens because there were laws in place that made it impossible for Japanese immigrants to become citizens, even if they had come to the country as children, even if they'd been here for decades. It was race-based.
Sure. How did they determine your ethnicity? What if I'm 1/4, 1/8? How do you know if you're a Japanese American?
Well, that's a good question. In fact, I don't know how far they went with that, but certainly anyone with a Japanese surname or anyone who was unable to pass, in quotes, was taken away.
So if I was a small businessman or woman,
yeah,
do I have to sell my business?
Yes.
Do I sell my home?
You do.
Well, that's a fire sale, isn't it?
It is a fire sale. So, of course, the prices, everyone knew that the Japanese Americans were going to be leaving in short order and had very little room to bargain. So they sold their property at fire sale prices. You're absolutely right.
So then they traipse off to these places. What was the press coverage of it? What were the talk shows at the time saying? The editorials saying?
It was mixed. There were people who said it wasn't necessary, but there were also many, many articles, and I think they were really the prevailing ones, that that fed into this hysteria that, oh, we have to get these people out of here. And it's also important to note, in Hawaii, which had the largest percentage of people of Japanese ancestry of any place in the United States, only a very few people were incarcerated because they constituted so large a part of the population that it would have destroyed the local economy to lock them up, which suggests that the move to do it in California was less purely for national security than was being argued.
And what was it for then?
Well, there were certainly people in California. There's a history of race-based laws in this country. Some of them had gone to the Supreme Court. The fact that Japanese immigrants could not become citizens. There were laws in California limiting Japanese American ownership of land.
Well, how was this constitutional?
It wasn't constitutional.
It was extra constitutional. I mean, literally, didn't they have an attorney who went to the Supreme Court and said, you can't do this?
Well, there were people who said that, and there were Japanese Americans who refused to cooperate. Many of them did cooperate, and the Japanese American Citizens League was a group designed to encourage the integration of Japanese citizens of Japanese ancestry into the American public. And they encouraged people to cooperate. And they said, this is the way we will demonstrate our loyalty.
Your patriotism.
You will show your patriotism by going along. And eventually, many people joined the military. Many of the men joined the military also in an effort to demonstrate their loyalty to this country.
Well, we have Muslim Americans today that are in the U.S. military. I mean, I don't know. Is this kind of in the backdrop of that? Do you position the exhibit that way?
Absolutely. This is one of the reasons to do the show. It's not just an anniversary. It's that the current discussions about how we treat people who we think might have loyalties elsewhere, at least we fantasize that they might. What do we do about that? Do we lock them up? Do we constrain their ownership privileges for businesses and for property? It's absolutely, when people say it can't happen here, not only has it happened here, it could happen again. And that's something that Japanese Americans themselves feel very strongly.
In the exhibit, it's pretty striking. In the film that accompanies the exhibit, it's pretty striking to see some of these photographs, of businesses that say no, J-A-P-S, Lord, I don't know if that's something you say on the radio or not. It sure feels pejorative, doesn't it? But it's just amazing how blatant some of the racism was.
Absolutely. And we have a video in the exhibition where a woman is talking about the fact that as they packed up and left, there were people who put signs in the window saying, "Sorry to see you go." But there were just as many that said, "Get out, you traitor." So,
even though and by the way, we're talking about women and children, too.
Absolutely. Women and children, orphans. There were everybody. It was, you know, if there was, we have a photograph of an elderly blind man being escorted off the train after he'd been forced to leave.
That's, you know, that's really the answer I thought I'd get from you earlier. It strikes me as punitive. This is not constructive. It's like, damn it, they bombed Pearl Harbor. They tried to cripple our fleet. They're trying to win a world war with a sneak attack. By God, if I can't turn back the clock, I'm just going to start to put all of those people in camps.
I think that's entirely fair. And the fearing that war with Japan was coming, there had been a lot of discussion about what to do and how to respond. Franklin Roosevelt was not in favor of this policy until he was. And Eleanor Roosevelt was never in favor of it.
Yeah, of course.
But there had been a report written by a Midwestern businessman named Curtis Munson, and he did this at the government's request, examining the loyalty of Japanese Americans in 1942. So the Issei, the generation who had come from Japan, and he said, well, they chose to be here, so they're loyal. And the Nisei, their children, who were born here and were citizens, he said, well, they were raised in, you know, in America, and they are raised with American values, and they're loyal. And then the Kibei, those are the ones born here but sent back for their formal education, sent back to Japan, he said many of them return more loyal than ever. So, in fact, you really have, you know, it is only the great exception that we should worry about. And that report was delivered to the White House exactly 1 month before Pearl Harbor. But, of course, it was completely overlooked.
So the level of propaganda then, how does this happen in the government sector and in the private sector? How is this justified or promulgated is really a fascinating part of the story, too, and resonates these days as well. We'll pick it up here in just a minute. Tony Herschel's in our studio, the director of exhibitions at the Alpha Wood Gallery. The address for it again is
2401 North Halsted in Chicago.
And I want you to know how to go to this. It's a free exhibit, right?
It is free. And we are open 5 days a week. Wednesday and Thursday, 11 to 8, and Friday, Saturday, and Sunday from 11 to 6.
Okay, more about this in just a minute. It's 151 WGN Radio News at 2 o'clock, too. And by the way, Susana Mendoza, who now has, I believe, Steve Bertrand, a bigger piggy bank, the comptroller will now have more money to spend, talks to us about, if I think I'm getting this right.
She writes the checks.
She writes the checks, and doesn't she determine the order in which the checks get written?
She's got some authority there, yes.
So my question to her is going to be, okay, so what happens next? And we'll talk about that after, too. For just another couple of minutes here is Tony Herschel, the director of exhibitions at the Alpha Wood Gallery. It's on Halsted in Chicago. And here is a display unlike anything you've seen. Actually, some of these pictures you've seen before. But it's nice to have them all in one place with a really smart, about 45-minute film that accompanies it, too. And it sort of tells the story of the internment of the Japanese. The government promoted this. I mean, they had propaganda films, right?
They did.
Which are just strikingly blatant. It's amazing that people bought, you know, this, very dramatic, surreal, the Japanese are coming and you need to be safe kind of crap.
People were frightened. And, you know, I think we have less excuse now when we have 24/7 access to news from around the world. But people were frightened and it was easy to convince them.
So do you think we made progress? I don't mean to bait you with that question. I mean, I presume we have.
I'd like to think so. But the fact that we can be talking about locking up whole groups of people or penalizing whole groups of people because we fear certain members of their group.
We're not talking about locking up whole groups of Muslims in this country, right? We're talking about banning the immigration of some people.
That's true, although some people have been raising the specter of camps like this again.
It comes up in the film, and you just kind of slap your head because what you say is, okay, that's ridiculous, that's stupid, we're not going to do it, we shouldn't do it, and we can't do that. But the very dialogue is a little unsettling, isn't it?
It is. People at the time recognized Milton Eisenhower, Dwight Eisenhower's youngest brother was the first head of the War Relocation Authority, and he found it so painful that he quit after 3 months and recruited a friend of his to run the agency instead. So there were a lot of, and the government realized the scale of this, the expense, the logistics. They tried hard to start finding ways to get people out of the camps because they realized it was a colossal mistake to have put them in camp.
I got 30 seconds left, but Roddy on line one says, didn't this start with some sort of land disagreement?
That was certainly one factor, particularly in California. They had passed laws that made it impossible for Japanese immigrants to own land, so they would buy the land in the names of their citizen children. Then further laws were passed to prevent that. And there was a sense that certain parts of the agriculture market were being dominated by the Japanese, and this was uncomfortable and unwelcome. So good riddance. There was a desire to send people away. So it wasn't purely about national security, although that is the excuse that was given.
Well done, Tony. It's nice to meet you in person. I'll meet you out at your studio sometime soon and check this out. It runs until
November 19.
Okay, so you got no excuse. Get on out to Alpha Wood Gallery. It's open 5 days a week. The days are Wednesday, Thursday?
Wednesday and Thursday, 11 to 8. Friday, Saturday, Sunday, 11 to 6.
The show is free. And again, it's called Then They Came For Me. Nice to meet you. Thanks for coming.
Nice to meet you. Thank you so much.
Susana Mendoza, our state comptroller, is on the phone line. Now that we've got a budget, she probably wants to call in on the bright side and tell us what her good news is. Susana, this is John. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. Very much.
What is the definition of your job? What are you supposed to do?
Well, I'm supposed to manage the state's fiscal accounts. That is the official responsibility. But over the last 7 months that I've been in office, it's been more of a trauma center for the state of Illinois, and we've been triaging all the victims of the budget impasse. So I'm glad that right now, with the passage of a budget, while it's far from perfect, very imperfect, as a matter of fact, but nonetheless, it stops the hemorrhaging, and we're going to go from being the main trauma center of the state to more like a room for stabilization and eventually, hopefully, a recovery room.
It's an interesting analysis. I want to ask you a little bit about what bills get paid and in what order, but what's your problem with this, Susana? You're not thrilled about this. What's wrong with it?
No, I'm happy that we have a budget because it puts a cap to the deficit spending that was just running wild over the last 2 years. The problem, though, is that we still have a bill backlog of $15 billion that has to be addressed. That was the result of not having a budget over the last 2 years. And unfortunately, the governor inherited a mess. And so what happened before him is not, on him. But unfortunately, rather than fixing it, just over the last 2 years alone, he's more than tripled the backlog of bills to what is now $15 billion. And we don't have the revenue, even with the increase in the income taxes and even with additional borrowing, we're still going to be handling how we pay down that bill backlog over a matter of many years, not just, one budget cycle.
Yeah. What would you have preferred to see?
I would have preferred to see a budget in year one of the Rauner administration, not in year three, because then we would not have a $15 billion bill backlog. And, it's a lot of could have, would have, should have, but they're under no circumstances should any state in the country go an entire year without a budget. It is a recipe for disaster. And, our universities, five of them now, places like Carbondale, Illinois, Southern Illinois University, you never would have thought they'd be in junk bond status. But that is all a direct result of the budget impasse. And there's five universities like that. Last year, we lost 16,000 college-bound kids to out-of-state schools, a net loss of 16,000 kids, because their parents don't know if the universities are still going to be around. Thankfully, with this budget, they will be around, but nobody should have to go through that type of instability or unpredictability when deciding where to go to school.
What does this do to our bond rating, our status? At what percentage rate will Illinois be borrowing money?
Well, we don't know because that changes, on a daily basis, but it's going to be terrible. So for folks who maybe haven't been following this as closely, it's kind of the equivalent of if you had perfect credit, you can go buy a car at 0% interest. If you have terrible credit, you owe everyone and your grandmother money, you're going to have terrible credit rating. You go to try to buy a car. If you're even lucky enough that someone is willing to lend you money,
right,
it might be at like 30%, right? So this is the state of the state's finances. Our credit is, it almost couldn't be worse, but, you know, it actually could be worse. And we were at the brink of it going into junk bond status had this budget not passed yesterday. So
I remember seeing
with all its warts.
Yeah.
It's still good that it passed, you know what I mean, even with all the warts.
Sure, understood. And I don't remember now if this was a city or county, but I think it was a state issue that instead of borrowing it at 1% or 1-something, we're borrowing it at 6 or 6-something.
The city, yeah, the city. I mean, it was because of the they had to take out the loan because the state hadn't been paying the money that they needed to open schools up on time, right? So they had to go back to the bond market. And, you know, when your credit is already junk, you don't have, you're not the one in the driver's seat. The credit, the lenders are. And, you know, basically Illinois is at a point where we have to hope that there are predatory lenders out there that want to offer us money because we still have to pay these bills. But it's the worst of circumstances, and it was completely avoidable. If we would have had a budget in place a year ago, even if it wasn't perfect, it still would have prevented us from getting into a position where we are now $15 billion behind on paying the bills. And that runner backlog is going to cost taxpayers money for many, many years to come. That's just the truth.
Well, you can call that the runner backlog, and I respect that. I appreciate that. I mean, I think we're all frustrated with the governor. We're also frustrated with Mike Madigan and the Democrats. And I know we all have our own partisan views on these things, but I think it's on both of them. I am just as mad at Mike Madigan, who's been there a lot longer than Bruce Rauner.
Yeah, I think there's plenty of blame to go around. And like I said, Democrats and Republicans. And I think that the governor's made a good, he's really tried to drive it into everybody's brain that this 32%, you know, he calls it the Madigan tax. But I would just argue that had he done his job in year one, we wouldn't need this 32%, which, by the way, is the very same rate that the governor stipulated as part of his negotiations to even start talking about this.
One last thing. Who gets
that? What I can tell you, though, just to finish this point, is that when Governor Rauner took office in 2015, the state had been paying down the bill backlog, and it had gotten down to $5 billion. That's math. It's not Democratic or Republican. That's just math. When he took office, that bill backlog, as a result of no budget for 2 years under his leadership, has now tripled. It's gone from, he wants to talk about a 32% increase in the tax. How about we needed that, unfortunately, to deal with the 200% increase in the bill backlog. So he has to take responsibility for what happened under his watch. Certainly the speaker has plenty of responsibility, as does anybody that served in office. I'll even say myself included. But, you know, we have to acknowledge that in order to do things better, we've got to come to the table in good faith and actually figure out how are we going to triage, to not spend beyond our means. When you're a fiscal conservative, the governor explained to me how it's okay that the state of Illinois has been operating at $600 million deficit a month under his leadership. That's not being fiscally conservative. That's running us into the red.
Susanna, my last question for you, I just have about 45 seconds here, is who gets paid first? Or can you give me an example of how now expedited monies are going to go back to the people?
Sure. So remember that we're not going to get these revenues in for a few months because the tax literally just passed. It takes a while to start collecting that revenue. So it's not like we have this big influx of cash. But what we do is have the ability through a budget to tap into some funds that were sitting there collecting revenue for things like higher education, MAP grants, things of that nature, that we can now actually take some of those hundreds of millions of dollars and give them to these starving universities so that they can make their debt service payments and not get further deeper into junk status. That's been going to be one of the top priorities.
Susanna Mendoza, State Comptroller, appreciate your time. I know you're having a busy day. Thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks so much. Have a great one. Bye-bye.
I got an idea how we can get some of this money even quicker into the system, and I think this is really our future anyway. WGN, this is John. Are you there?
Loans, fine jewelry, evaluated, and more loans. How's can I help you?
This is John Williams from WGN Radio, and that was...
Bye, my staff will check the status of your loan.
No, I don't have a loan. I don't need you to check on
here
my...
Here it is, WGN Radio, Sam Zell, owes us $83 million. You ready to make a payment?
No, I'm not calling about Sam Zell. I'm not here to make a payment.
Tell us the whereabouts of one Mr. Zell's kneecap.
No, look, you got the wrong guy. You got
How are your knees doing?
My knees are fine. I'm calling, though, about the state of Illinois.
Oh, wow.
Hello there. We've been expecting your call.
Yeah, I'll bet you have been, so maybe you can help.
Loans, fine jewelry evaluated, and more loans. We get money to good customers like you. I got a friend at the track, wanted to buy a vintage condition Cadillac.
Okay, so here's what I was calling.
He was, at the time, an apprentice dishwasher. He needed 74 large. Guess who made that happen, right?
So Illinois is still kind of teetering on the brink of junk bond status. We got this budget now, but the borrowing costs, I'm hearing, are just killing us. So I'm calling to see if we could borrow some money from you and get people paid more quickly.
Sure you can. As collateral, do you have parking meters?
No, we sold those.
Hallways?
No, we don't have those anymore.
Oh, how about the Skyway? That's a fine ticket.
Yeah, we sold the Skyway.
What do you got? I'm trying to help you out here, Mr. Williams, but you got to put something down for a loan here at Loans, Fine Jewelry Evaluated, and more loans.
Yeah. Maybe somebody out there's got an idea. What could we hawk? Because that's really what it's come down to. This is our future here. We're going to have to start hawking things or putting things down to at least get... I'm sorry, I didn't get your name. What was the name of the company that you are working with again?
I'll say it clearly for you. Yeah. Loans, Fine Jewelry Evaluated, and more loans.
All right. We'll be in touch. Thanks for your time. Karen Travers joins us from Hamburg, that's how I think we're now pronouncing it. She's the Washington correspondent for ABC News. Everybody's talking about the two-plus hour meeting between the President of the United States and Russia. Karen, this is John. Welcome to WGN Radio.
Thank you for having me on. I mean, this was a meeting that went more than four times as long as was scheduled, and by President Trump's length, incredibly long. You know, he's not somebody that sits down for these extensive, lengthy conversations, but this was a very intense conversation. And Secretary of State Rex Tillerson says that right out of the gate, President Trump brought up the issue of Russia's election meddling. He says he pressed Vladimir Putin on this issue. Now, Putin denied any interference, and according to Tillerson, the president wanted to move on. But interesting, a different take from the Russian side. The foreign minister, who was also in that meeting, says President Trump accepted that statement from President Putin. Senior administration official tells us that's just not true.
Boy, to be a fly on the wall. And here's the meeting with just four people and two translators. So we don't have any third-party verification of which side of the story is truer, right?
That's correct.
And and what you're telling me is, though, I mean, I think what we're wondering is these two guys sit down and they're talking about Russian meddling. Did they agree or not agree that the Russians meddled? And did the U.S. accept or not accept their version of it? Can you clear that up?
I can't. I mean, I can tell you what Rex Tillerson said, and then there was certainly a different narrative then coming from his Russian counterpart. You know, the administration says he did not accept it, but didn't keep pressing the issue because he felt that it wasn't worth it to relitigate the past.
Well, I want to believe, you know, if I have to pick a side, I always want to believe the United States, although this administration's been sometimes less than perfectly truthful with us, but I think I'll believe our version of events over theirs, and I guess that's what I'm left with, huh?
That's probably where things stand right now.
I know that you've got to go. Any last thing that you want to insert here, Karen?
No, I think that's kind of the big headline coming out of this. I think also the fact of Rex Tillerson saying what a strong connection that they had, really emphasizing the personal relationship that he felt was beginning between the two presidents.
Karen, if I can ask a real quick one. We're seeing Tillerson apparently said that at one point Melania Trump was sent into the meeting to try to break it up or to get them moving along. That doesn't seem to make sense. Do you know what happened there?
That's what we're told, that she tried to get the meeting to wrap up because they wanted to move on to the next part of the schedule, but they kept going for another hour after that.
Thank you for your time this afternoon, Karen. We'll visit again. We sure appreciate your reporting.
Thank you.
Our bright side in a couple of seconds and a few things for you to do this weekend. Steve, this will be near and dear to your heart.
Hit me.
Well, Ryan handed me and sent, I guess, to members of the staff a roundup of some of the most popular, I'm reading now, but completely untrue headlines of the week.
Don't even want to touch those.
None of these stories are legit, even though they were shared widely on social media. So this isn't AP or CNN or even Breitbart getting it wrong. This is just stuff that one way or another are floating out there. But widely shared across the country. The Associated Press checked these out, and they aren't true. Headline, not real, 5 rhino poachers killed by 4 angry rhinos. There was news about rhinos, but this did not happen. Not real. Breaking. Barrels removed from Clinton property contained parts from 3 missing women. Those kinds of stories will always be out there, and there always will be people that believe anything sinister about the Clintons. I didn't see that one. Shame on you if you believed it. Barrels removed from the Clinton property contained parts from 3 missing women. Not real. Albert Almora showed his middle finger to President Trump. I saw this, and I saw this in a credible source. I don't remember what it was, but it was mainstream media.
Were they saying that it was true or that it just looked like it was?
That he did not give the finger to the president.
Right, right.
You've seen the blown up picture of his hand, and you see a finger. But if you look even more closely, he has 2 fingers that are, I think, half tucked in, half tucked out of his pocket. So you see 2 fingers displayed, but he's not giving the finger to the president. Not real. Iconic actor and martial artist Jet Li dies from hyperthyroidism at the young age of 54.
He was 55.
No. He struggles with that, but he's fine. He's okay. He did not die. Not real. Headline, Spicer. Trump has the legal right to cancel SCOTUS because they serve at his pleasure. There's a story circulating around. They're saying that Donald Trump has the legal right to just throw people off the Supreme Court because he believes they serve at his pleasure, and that's being attributed to Sean Spicer. White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer never claimed that. That story is not true.
Well, mine of the week, you know, would be...
Yeah.
You just baited me.
I think it's telling.
Yeah, that 15-year-old boy created video of Donald Trump beating up the CNN thing at the World Wrestling Federation.
Yeah.
CNN reported they found the person and said they weren't going to identify him because he had expressed regret and they didn't want to put him at risk.
That's true.
That's all true. All of a sudden, these stories come out that CNN is blackmailing this person and that it was a 15-year-old boy. Donald Trump Jr. talked about it being a 15-year-old boy.
Yeah.
And it's not. And
95% of what Donald Trump Jr. says. Well, you should unfollow him. I haven't, but... He's not helping you.
So my son comes upstairs from the basement yesterday from where he lives in his cave and said, yeah, I can't believe CNN did this to this 15-year-old boy. You know, it's all over Reddit that as if it's true. It's not true. It's the people who complain the most about fake news who spread it, I think. That's my opinion.
I wonder what the value... You know, I wonder if Reddit cares or thinks or knows how it's being used, what its persona is. Like, you know... Reddit's not Twitter, it's not texting, it's not CNN, it's...
Well, they went through it for a while when a lot of it was violent and racist, and, you know, they tried to police it a little bit more.
Well, remember how it sort of did a disservice to everybody after the Boston Marathon bombings. They outed the wrong person. You know, they were using sort of crowdsourcing to find out who these people were, and sometimes they get it wrong. I'm sorry, Steve, so you were saying?
No, I know from time to time they've taken steps to try to clean up, but... I mean, part of Reddit's appeal is that it is
what it is.
It's unruly.
Yeah. And that can be a good thing or a bad thing. But I don't even understand, and maybe you can just walk me through this one more time. Earlier today, you tried to. How is the fact that CNN, fearing for this person's safety, doesn't out him? How is that blackmail?
I think their statement said something to the effect that he regretted doing it, and he assured CNN that he wouldn't do it anything like that again. So the opponents of CNN were taking that as a pound of flesh. He's promised us not to do it again, but we will reveal him if he does in the future.
Okay,
and I think they did say that. I think they did say, you know, he said he wouldn't continue this behavior. You know, if he keeps it up, we reserve the right to reveal him in the future. But it wasn't in exchange for silence or anything like that.
Well, but it's not CNN's job to bring somebody into line. I mean, I'm surprised they're making that deal.
To what? To make... Well, I think I don't know if they were making a deal.
That's tacit the point, deal. Yeah. I mean, but if their explanation is he's not going to do it anymore, therefore we won't reveal him. But if he does, we will. That's not blackmail, but that's also not journalism. I don't think that's their reason.
Well, I think their point is why put this guy at risk or make him the center of something?
Okay, then
as long as he said I regret it, I would never do anything like that again.
Yeah.
And if he does, well, then maybe they'll say he was lying to us. And
okay, that's a tough call for me. But even still,
he's not 15. That's the biggest thing. They're making it sound like they were going after a 15-year-old boy. The guy's a middle-aged man.
Well, but even then, it's not blackmail, is
no,
it?
I know. But it's different to... No, you're right. But it's one thing to go after and threaten to expose a middle-aged man as opposed to a 15-year-old boy.
Yeah, right.
And that's what Donald Trump Jr. jumped on. He's not 15. He was, but a long time ago.
Well, I'm sure that Donald Trump Jr. will be tweeting an apology to the planet about this. My bad. Sorry, CNN. You got it right or you didn't get it wrong. Or I'm wrong. That's all you got to say. Let me know when you get that tweet. It's 251. I'm sorry. It's 241. 241. We've got time for the bright side. This is where you call in and tell us some good news in your world. Why you are smiling. It can be large. It can be small. We're opening up all 12 phone lines now. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Text or call. And while we get to the phone lines, here are some things you might want to do this weekend. Chicago, you've got the Taste of Chicago at Grant Park through Sunday the 9th. The Passion Pit's performing tomorrow, or Passion Pit. Chicago, Lincoln Square, Square Roots Fest from noon to 9. Features a plethora of local craft beers and food from neighborhood vendors. Art market and live music. That's in Lincoln Square this weekend. Wilmette, Kenilworth area, family fun night, karaoke, 6:30 to 9 o'clock tonight at 1150 Central Avenue. There's food and booze choices. In Barrington tonight, it's the Sidewalk Sale Fun Days through tomorrow, featuring local artisans and merchants offering good prices and pretty nice artwork in Barrington. In Manuka, hey, that's where I went to high school. Four rivers in one round-trip kayak tour, meeting at McKinley Woods, Frederick's Grove from 9 to 1. You'll see such animals as turtles, mated pair, mute swans, coots, egrets, herons. Get tickets at eventbrite.com. I think I'm going to get this right. Four rivers in one round-trip kayak tour, and that starts at McKinley Woods. Go to eventbrite.com to find out more.
Always look on the bright side of life.
I just got a text from my friend Beth Swerk, longtime producer. How about them apples?
It must have been a group text. I did too.
Hey, Steve, don't yuck my yum. If Beth sends me a text, let me enjoy that.
That's how I started. I was interning for Beth and John Williams here at WGN Radio.
Think about that. All right, Kevin, you go first. Your mic's hot. What's your bright side?
All right, bright side, I'm going to play some more golf this weekend. If I haven't already played enough this week, I've got another outing tomorrow, and I can't wait. So I'm excited for
it. How about you, Steve Bertrand? What's making you smile?
The painters just finished staining my house and painting the trim. I'm going to sit in the yard all weekend and just watch it fade.
Yeah, and realize that in a few years I'll have to do it all over again. Wait a minute. I'm not supposed to say that. That's the bright side. Okay, here come your phone calls. 312-981-7200. John, you go first. Why are you smiling today, my friend?
We have a balanced budget in Illinois that's only $5 billion in the hole.
Woohoo! Cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs.
Always look on the right side of life.
All right, Marilyn, it's your turn. What's your bright side? Why are you smiling?
Tomorrow night I'm going to attend a dinner at the weekend reunion of my mother's family, and this is the 45th consecutive year.
Wow.
We have people from 8 states.
What's the family? Give me the last name.
Fitzgerald.
Congratulations to y'all, Marilyn. Thanks for the call. How about this? Joseph, you're on WGN. What's your bright side? Why are you smiling, Joe?
I'm smiling because in a week, me and my family are going to go on vacation to Alabama. And when we come back, my mom said she's going to give me a tortoise for my birthday.
The bright side of life.
That boy, Joe. Happy birthday in advance. Jana, you're on WGN. Why are you smiling?
Well, my oldest son, Eric Rudis, is retiring from the Marine Corps after 20 years. He's done 5 tours of duty, and he's the officer in charge of explosives ordnance detonation.
So his mom's really anxious for him to be done with that, huh?
So are his wife and 6 children.
Always look on the right side of life.
All right, Pam, you go next. You're on WGN. What's your bright side?
My bright side is our grandson, Stone Fisher Smith, is 3 years old today.
Happy birthday!
Life seems jolly rotten.
How about on line 6? Gary, you're on WGN. What's your bright side? Why are you smiling, sir?
Yeah, John, we've been married for 55 years today.
Oh,
my wife and I.
Tell me something wise. Pass along a little married wisdom for us here, Gary.
Just say yes to everything she asked for.
Who saw that coming? Who saw that coming?
I did.
Hey, Kim, is your bright side that I parked in the right spot today?
I'm so proud of you, John.
I was very careful about how I lined that bad boy up.
You know what? I took the train today.
Violetta Podramatic is, I believe. Is that Violetta that I see? No, somebody else.
No, it's Susan Burkus.
Susan, do you want to play on the bright side? You have something good in your world you care to share?
It's all good. It's summer in Chicago, right?
I'm kidding. That's all you need. The sun is shining. It's in the middle 80s. That works for me. Here we go.
Always look on the right side of life.
Lots of phone calls to get to. We go to Sharon next. You're on WGN. What's your bright side, Sharon?
Hi, my husband John was diagnosed a year ago with stage 3 prostate cancer and just got a cancer undetectable test. Come back great. And thank you to his doctor, Dr. Moadine, and their team.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that, Sharon. I'll bet that's a great relief for you all, huh?
Oh, it is. And my husband actually just texted you, too. So if there's a text, you know, we didn't know if we could get through. So we just wanted to tell you.
That's the way to
thank
do it.
So
atta girl, Sharon. Congrats.
Thanks.
You bet. How about Carol? You're on WGN. Carol, what's your bright side?
Hey, John. I am so excited. I played a golf course today, and I got my first eagle. It was a short par 4, 194 yards. I drove the green, and I put it in, and I eagled. I was so excited.
Nicely done. How about that? Hurry on. Bring it home. All right, Penny, you go next. You're on WGN. Why are you smiling?
Hi, this is Penny, and I'm calling because my 3 kids are at sleepaway camp all week long, so we got a nice break, but we get them back tomorrow.
So what's a bigger day for you, the day they leave or the day they come back?
The day they leave.
If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you forgot.
Hey, Bonnie, this is John. Why are you smiling? You're on WGN. Hi.
I just found out that my dizzy spells are not my brain, it's an inner ear.
Oh, whew. Your brain may have its own problems, but this ain't nothing to worry about, huh?
But it's not going to kill me.
Hey, Jerry, this is John. You're on WGN. Why are you smiling, Jer?
Oh, I'm smiling because my wife just got a great performance review, a big raise, and a gigantic bonus. And we're going to be going to Hawaii for our 20th in October.
How about that? We do this on Fridays. It's called The Bright Side. Tell your friends to listen, too, and call in early. Text often. And we'll do it again next Friday. On tomorrow's show, I'm on from 10 to noon Saturday mornings after Lou Manfredini's Mr. Fix-It. Here's a shout-out to Lou. The Bright Side is back here on WGN Radio because Lou insisted. So thank you for that, Mr. Manfredini. I do like this segment, and I'm really glad that you all are participating. Lots of phone calls, lots of texts, and we'll take more of them next week. After Lou's show on Saturday, tomorrow, I'll visit with a Chicagoan who has written a book about how movies are prayers. Movies are prayers. He said he's a very religious person, but he's also a film critic. And usually when he reviews movies, he doesn't do so from the perspective of a religious outlook. He does movie reviews. He's a religious person, writes sometimes along those lines. But his book talks about how so many of the movies that we have seen, scenes that we relate to, characters that we come to know and love, are themselves doing the sorts of things that we do when we pray.
It's kind of a stretch, isn't it? But he makes his case really well. My question for him, though, as I've been reading the book, and, you know, they aren't religious movies. I mean, he's talking about Ferris Bueller's Day Off, for crying out loud. So he'll take something like penitence or sacrifice or you know, strength and courage, things that we pray for or religious themes. And he says, in movies, here's how these sorts of things are expressed. My point to him, my question is the prayer come from the movie makers, or does the prayer come from us as we watch them? Like, I don't have to go to church this week because I watched Ferris. We'll talk a little bit about these very interesting movies, his very interesting premise, and his really interesting take on these things. And that will be on our show tomorrow. He'll be on with us at 10:30 here on WGN. Kim Gordon is in the WGN radio newsroom. And just one last thing, Kim, about my ability / inability to park my car.
Uh-huh.
I know that you're getting ready for the news there, so I won't keep you or dwell on this.
No, I'm ready.
But I am now parked in the correct spot, right?
Thank you. I don't know. I honestly did take the train today, so I was not in the parking lot.
I did move it over one spot.
Thank you.
And I actually did a lap around the parking lot inside so that I could kind of come in straight ahead. There was room in the previous row so that I could cut through that and come in perpendicular. And I have never more conscientiously, or consciously anyway, parked a car. I believe I have about 18 to 24 inches on either side.
That is a tough spot to park in. Because of the van next to you, it's not easy to get in that spot because it's a quick turn.
Thank you. Steve Cochran's show, again this week, spent way too much time.
I heard you were abused.
What did you think of that?
It was, they were tough on you.
Yeah. So that's my bright side, that I was able to move the car. I parked it, and I feel really good about that. John, I'm going to Sagatuck for a long weekend from the 815 area code. John, Barb in Michigan, I won Detroit Tiger baseball tickets. Well, you didn't win them from us, but have a good trip. John, we're selling our house. The buyer wanted us to have the attic checked for mold, and there was no mold. Woo-hoo. There's some bright sides. Anna DeVlantis just strolling into the studio, putting her headphones on and adjusting her microphone.
I need to check my house for mold now. That just reminded me.
Yeah, how are you? You know, I've been speaking ad nauseum about my move.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't heard you guys dwell on yours a lot.
No.
Has that been a big topic?
No, it hasn't been a big topic. Because,
how do you do that?
Well, the air conditioning's out currently. We've got lots of problems. And so I was just talking to Ro about it, just off camera. I prefer to say that this is going to pass and we'll get through this. But right
That's
now,
all what I've been
ugly.
Saying to her. We talk about it during the breaks, and I say to her, this too shall pass. Because moving, there's nothing worse.
Oh, there isn't.
I have just redone my house, so I'm never leaving again. I mean, I may have to get one of those, the Stairmaster lift, or what do they call those things?
Yeah, the stair chairs that go up the stairway.
I may have to get one of those before it's all said and done, but I ain't
mm-hmm.
leaving.
No, I
agree. Take me out feet first.
It's like, yeah.
We've looked at each other and said, we're never doing this again.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what we said 4 years ago when we moved last time.
Yeah.
But I think this time we really mean it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good. I mean, the thing is that when you move and you have things like all of your possessions, you don't know where anything is. It's all there on a countertop somewhere in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not where it's supposed to be. It's not organized. It's confounding. I remember when I moved into this place 3 years ago, 4 years ago, it was it was just insane. It took me months to figure out where to put stuff.
Oh, yeah, that's where we are right now. And, you know, it's funny, too, because they put everything about. We had movers move us. It was wonderful.
Nice.
And they're a nice company. They were good guys. But I have a big box, and it says on it, you know, they label it,
mm-hmm.
pen holder. I said, what's a pen holder? And this is like a 36 by 24-inch box.
Ooh.
Pen holder. It was some pillows. It was a little one of those desk organizers where you do put a pen,
uh-huh.
but it was a lot more stuff
sure.
than that.
Was that the first thing that went in or the last thing that went in? And then they decided to mark that.
Pen. I know. Somebody lost interest in labeling that box after
yeah.
pen holder.
Sure, why not? I totally get it, though. I feel both of your pains.
Thank you.
And I just want to say until I get the, you know, the stair lifter thing, you know. Which is less expensive than I thought it was going to be, according to the guy who's got the oxygen in his nose. I'm with him.
Uh-huh.
I got to get that.
Good way to go.
That's going to be
avoid
next,
the move.
Yeah, it's
going to
be my next
costs.
Thing. Right.
So who are we going to believe, Ro, the president of Russia or the president of the United States on what that little meeting was like today?
Well, we haven't heard from the president himself. We've only heard from the White House. And sometimes the White House says something and then the president says the opposite. So we don't really know for sure. But Vladimir Putin says that that Donald Trump accepted his explanation that the Russians had nothing to do with meddling in the election.
Right.
And then the White House says, and Rex Tillerson also said, no, that's
I
not
don't
what
accept
happened.
That.
No,
yeah.
We didn't accept it.
Mm-hmm.
So.
All right.
We'll see. So, I don't, you know, all I know is that their poor Melania got stuck in, you know, whatever she's staying in right now, the hotel or some home somewhere.
Senate chambers or something.
Yeah.
And she tried to break up the meeting after an hour between Putin and her husband.
How about that?
Wasn't that fascinating?
They sent her in to try to stop it. And it's like, what were his staff so afraid he was doing in there that they had to send her in?
Yeah. And she wasn't able to do it. And an hour later, I mean, and then they met for another hour after she went in.
What did she say when she walks in?
Excuse me.
Do a Melania. I want to hear that.
Excuse me. I wanted to have. We're going over to see Beethoven now. Come on. Let's go.
We have boat tour.
Come on, you two. You can talk on phone later. Come on. You know, like
she does
that.
Speak German, and Putin apparently speaks German. So potentially there might have been something there.
That would have been helpful.
I think she speaks Russian, too.
Well,
she speaks seven
languages. Yeah, she does. And
does
that
she
might
really?
Have been a way that she could have helped in that situation. But
I just don't know why. But what have they got to do that is more important than what they're doing? I mean, if the two leaders of those two nations are talking.
Trying to negotiate a ceasefire in Syria and some other.
We are going to be late for show. You told me you were taking me to show. We are going to show.
I don't know. I mean, it seemed like they said they sent her. It was not. You could tell she doesn't. She's only half interested in this anyway, right? So it's not like she's going to be the one who's like, I got to get in there and save him. No, it was there was like Spicer or somebody or Reince or I don't know Bannon going get in there. I don't know what he's doing. I'm not sure what he's doing. Get in there before something bad happens. It'll be interesting if it were Bannon, or it couldn't have been. They would have sent Ivanka in if she were there.
Can't you see her going in and all three of those heads, Bannon, Spicer, and Priebus, all kind of looking over the top of each other, with craning their necks around the door. Oh, no, what did she say?
What
did she say? Get back, get back, get back, get back.